Okay, the next speaker is me. Sustainable engineering is something I've been thinking about for a long time. I began to pursue it more seriously last fall. Last summer, I stepped down as department chair and did a sabbatical at Villanova University, which is one of the few places in the country with graduate program in sustainable engineering. My main time-consuming thing I did there is to take unofficially two classes in sustainable engineering. And what I'm saying today is very different than what I would have said if I gave this presentation a year ago. I'm pleased to come back to my old home. My whole life changed when I was at Colorado School of Mines. I got 2 degrees in metallurgical engineering, so I learned a great deal about the real world, and that shaped my entire career. I also became a Christian in the fall of my junior year here at the Colorado School of Mines. The whole trajectory of my life in terms of engineering and then my faith component happened while I was at this school. So the question is, why do I want to care about sustainable engineering? As we've heard before, the global population will continue to grow. What I see as a really big problem, even more perhaps than that, is global affluence is growing. And as more and more people become middle class, they're going to want to live in lifestyles that's going to take up more energy and more of everything else. And some people estimate the human impact on the earth may double in 13 years from now. And one of the ways to do that is to redesign our global technology, and sustainable engineering is certainly an aspect of that. So what is sustainable engineering? One of the things that's interesting, I teach an engineering ethics class every year, is how recently engineers, at least in an official sense, started caring about it. Individuals may have cared about it for a long time, but it's gotten in the engineering code relatively recently. ASME code says engineers shall consider environmental impact and sustainable development in the performance of their professional duties, which I think is a very positive statement. I try to figure out when did that first appear. I don't know when it first appeared, but as recently, at least to me, as 1992, it was not in the ASME code. Another one, NSPE is the National Society of Professional Engineers, an umbrella group. They say engineers are encouraged to adhere to the principle of sustainable development in order to protect the environment for future generations. Question is, when did NSPE decide this was important? In 2006. So as many engineers have come rather lately to this issue. Another example that had impact on me, I remember going on April 22, 1970, to the first Earth Day. There was one in Denver as well as many other places. And I was interested. I wasn't a Christian at that point, but I was already interested in environmental issues. And Senator Nelson is the one who really created what we commonly think of as Earth Day. So what is sustainable development? NSPE has this really long definition, which is largely true, I think. It's a challenge of meeting human needs for natural resources, products, energy, food, transportation, shelter, and effective waste management while conserving and protecting environmental quality and natural resource base essential for future development. So if one of my friends from church asked me, what is this sustainable development thing, I am not going to try to read them this statement. I learned a much simpler one when I was at Villanova University, and they say it's not unique to them, this definition, but no one really knew exactly where it came from. They define sustainable development with 4 words. And I like their quote. It's enough for all forever. And I really like that definition. We're talking about for all part is the part about the growing affluence in our world. But the idea is forever. You know, I mean, we saw several plenary talks that talked about that issue. If the whole world has a middle-class lifestyle, that doesn't necessarily mean the energy consumption of the U.S., but perhaps that of Europe would be less. But that's still going to put a real strain on the Earth's resources. So what's driving the engineering statement? Certainly there are government regulations. But what I've found interesting as a result of my sabbatical experience is government regulations play a role, but it's not the only thing. One of it is the desire to do good, and companies are getting pressure from consumers to be themselves more sustainable. And I went to a forum at Villanova last fall, and I had several people from major corporations say the people they are most thankful for promoting sustainable development is this little company called Walmart. They require every one of their suppliers to have an end of use plan for the things they sell through Walmart, and they're requiring all their suppliers to show their sustainability of their manufacturing of what they're doing. Now, do you think Walmart's doing this because they just want to feel good? No. Walmart's doing this because they can make money by it. They can make very much money by it, by bragging about how good they are. So some people will do things not necessarily from pure motives, but it still gets done. Another thing I've seen even in my own younger son is companies are getting pressure from employees, particularly what you think of as the millennials or people even after the millennials. They don't want to work for a company that is seen as not doing sustainability things. Another one is an ability to make more money. One of the things that was fascinating to me at my Villanova experience is they bring together about 15 companies twice a year to their sustainable people talk about sustainability within their company. They don't have any competitors in the room, and you could use anything you learn, but you can't say who did it because people still want their competitive advantage. The thing that was fascinating to me is this met the week after the election. And given some of the stated policies of the then President-elect Trump, I thought a lot of people there would be really discouraged, and that was not the case at all. A number of them said from the podium, the president's policies will have no effect on what we and our company are doing because we're doing the thing that's right, and by doing the thing that's right, we're making more money than ever before. So that's one of the reasons why I'm relatively hopeful, because irrespective of what government might do, people are finding out it's in their best interest. It's certainly related to climate change and pollution, but I think sustainable engineering is broader than that, and certainly global warming is part of climate change, but I don't think that's all there is to climate change either. So one of the things I think I could provide hopefully a little insight is on the side of why people are opposed to it. Most of my friends are opposed to climate change or say it's not happening. But from my own experience, I've been involved in politics on an extremely serious level for more than 25 years. You see there, I've been a delegate at 5 different state conventions, 4 in Louisiana and 1 in Texas, and I've been a national convention delegate in 2 times. So I know many of the people who, at least on an individual level, are climate deniers, and climate change deniers. I think there's a group of different types of people. Many people may be in one or maybe in more than one. One of them is, these groups overlap. One of them is, the true believers who say there is no climate change occurring. another one, and liberals believe in it, so it must not be true. but we live in a very polarized society. If one side proposes something, many people on the other side will reject it without listening to it. So it's true on both sides, but that is a real emotional reaction with lots of my friends. How can you support something that these liberals support? Another one, and we've already heard comments from the plenary speakers, climate change may be happening, but it's natural and we can't do anything about it. And overlapping this one is, it may be occurring, but God's in control and we have nothing to fear. God's not going to allow the earth to be messed up completely. But there is another group that says climate change may be occurring, but because of their conservative nature, they don't like the big government solutions that have been proposed by many people. And I will be honest, when I think of my friends who are, and others who are climate change deniers, I think this is the most influential of the group. I would put President Trump in this category. I mean, whatever else you think about. But the point is, people are saying, I don't like the solutions without having looked at, is it really happening? I think it's pretty clear it's really happening. I think that most of you in this room would say that. The question is, what do we do about it? And I think that's where people are open to change. I don't think the true believers are going to be convinced by more evidence. There's already plenty of evidence out there. But people who are bothered by governmental things, if you can show market-based solutions, I think a lot of this opposition will end. So how I've changed. I've been committed to doing sustainable engineering, but I was basically, I call myself a mild climate change skeptic. But I changed my perspective when I was at Villanova University last fall. Some of you may not see my conversion as totally complete. I think part of the fight over this is there is some temperature data that's not consistent with other temperature data, and people could have legitimate discussions about it. But I think it was the first plenary speaker talk about, 26,000 pieces of evidence to support climate change. So while I understand why some of my friends want to argue the global warming temperature thing, I don't try to argue with that with them. I talk about all the other aspects. One of the things we looked at in some of our classes last fall was a reference called www.anthropocene. And they talk about what's called the Great Acceleration. Lots of things began happening about 1950. Fertilizer consumption went up. Those initials OECD refers to basically Western Europe, Canada, US, Japan. BRICS, I don't know if you're familiar with that. The BRICS are Brazil, Russia, India, and China. And then everybody else. You see primary energy use has gone up dramatically. World population has, biosphere degradation has, ocean acidification. So what happened around 1950, do you think, that caused everything to start exploding? Any thoughts? What happened shortly before 1950?
The end of World War II.
We had this thing called World War II that devastated most of the industrialized world, at least in the European portion of the industrialized world, was pretty much wiped out. But the point is, the countries had begun to recover by then, and things started changing very, very rapidly. Here's a chart about growing affluence. This is the number of people who live on $1.25 a day. And you see in 1981, it was close to 2 billion. It's on the order of maybe 1.3 billion, which is still a lot of people, but dramatically less. And while one of the speakers was most concerned about population growth, when I look at the issue of sustainable development, I think this is the biggest problem. The world is getting more affluent. And I don't think any of us would try to say that's bad intrinsically. I wouldn't want to. I've been on mission trips in Haiti. I've been to Rwanda 5 times with students. I don't want to live like the people in Rwanda or Haiti live, to be honest. And they don't want to live that way either. They want to live like we live. And that is one of the big issues that we face. So what I'm trying to do is I'm not trying to deal with the complexity issues. I'm not trying to really deal with some of the details. I mentioned some of them to show how I became a believer in that climate change is real. But what I want to look at is the rest of this paper is largely theological. And I'm going to talk about two men named Francis. When I was a young Christian, one of the first books of Francis Schaeffer I read was Pollution and the Death of Man, a Christian View of Ecology in 1970. And then Pope Francis came out with the Laudato Si in 2015. If you haven't read these two books, neither one is very long. I would highly recommend reading both of them. What's amazed me is how similar they sounded, even though they're written so far apart. Their images are different. Schaeffer is seen as a hardcore conservative, which is probably true. In the early 80s, he was an unofficial advisor to a number of sub-cabinet people in the Reagan administration. I think it's fair to say Pope Francis did not have a worldwide image of being a hardcore conservative. You know, I was impressed, however, even though they're from different Christian traditions and 45 years apart, how similar some of the things they said were. Schaeffer starts off his book by quoting from an article by Lynn White, who says, our problems, this is 1968 or so, are not technological but stem from our worldview. Schaeffer agrees with that. He doesn't agree with White's perspective is it's a Christian worldview that caused all the problems. Schaeffer goes on to say, the part in yellow, men do what they think. Whatever their worldview is, this is the thing which will spill over into the external world. This is true in every area of life. Schaeffer says it's a biblical view of nature that gives nature a value. It's not just a weapon, it's not just apologetics, but it's a value in itself because God made it. And then he says, when we have dominion over nature, it's not ours. It belongs to God. And we are to exercise our dominion over these things, not as though entitled to exploit them, but it's things borrowed or held in trust. That's a typo there. They're not ours intrinsically. And I'll have a quote in a few minutes from Pope Francis who says substantially the very same thing. Now, Schaefer doesn't sound too conservative here. Why does strip mining turn the world into an absolute desert? What has brought about this ugly destruction of the environment? There's only one reason: man's greed. If I put this up at the beginning without telling you who said it, I think most of you, or many of you, would probably say that sounds like Pope Francis. And certainly, I think Pope Francis would agree with that. But this is spoken again by someone who is from a hardcore conservative background. He talks about early, Schaefer goes on to say, it costs more money at first to treat the land well. And I might read the whole thing. He said, the question is, or it seems to be, are we going to have an immediate profit and an immediate savings of time, or are we going to do what we really should do as God's children? That we need to be concerned about the world God has made for us. Well, Pope Francis begins his encyclical with a reference to Francis of Assisi. In fact, the title relates to a Latin phrase in Francis of Assisi. He says, he reminds us that our common home is like a sister with whom we share our life and a beautiful mother who opens her arms to embrace us. And if you read Francis of Assisi, he talks about being brothers to the birds and the animals. But one of the things I found fascinating is a lot of evangelical Protestants get real nervous when they see that. But certainly Schaefer would be in that conservative evangelical camp, and he doesn't say that. For the top quote, it's interesting. He says, we have the right to rid our house of ants, but we have no right to do is to forget to honor the ant as God made it. When we meet the ant on the sidewalk, we step over him. I'm not sure I do that. He's a creature like ourselves, not made in the image of God. I left the word out. It is true, but equal with man as far as creation is concerned. In this sense, Francis, this is of Assisi, use of the term brothers to the bird is not only theologically correct, but a thing to be intellectually thought of and practically practiced. So some people have said Francis of Assisi has some really weird ideas. Schaefer is agreeing with the Pope, although he wrote it 45 years earlier about that. So Pope Francis says, talking about St. Francis of Assisi, he said, faithful to Scripture invites us to see nature as a magnificent book in which God speaks to us and grants us a glimpse of his infinite beauty and goodness. Rather than a problem to be solved, the world is a joyful mystery to be contemplated with gladness and praise. I think this statement resonates very well with Yancey's speech at the banquet, you know, about the wonder of God and the wonder of God's creation. So Francis says that he's motivated by the worldview also. He writes, and you see in the second paragraph here, convinced as I am that change is impossible, that should be a title, without motivation, and a process of education, I offer some guidelines for human development to be found in the treasure of Christian spiritual experience. He weaves three different topics, justifications through. One of them, he says, he's consistent with prior Catholic social teaching, and quotes a lot of former previous popes. I'm not in a position to evaluate that one way or another. He also makes his recommendations. He says they're supported by good science. I don't agree with everything he says about the science, but I think that's probably largely true. What I want to look at is his recommendation is supported by Scripture and other faith aspects. Pope Francis says, we are not God. The earth was here before us and has been given to us. We must forcefully reject the notion that our being created in God's image and given dominion over the earth justifies absolute domination over other creatures. I find here Schaefer and Pope Francis are saying basically the same thing 45 years apart. The Pope says this responsibility for God's earth means human beings endowed with intelligence must respect the laws of nature and the delicate equilibrium existing between the creatures of this world. He also said believers must feel a challenge to live in a way consonant with their faith and not contradicted by their actions. When people become self-centered and self-enclosed, their greed increases. The emptier a person's heart is, the more he or she needs things to buy, own, and consume. And that's a quote that many people would easily believe that's something the Pope would say. But in slightly different phrases, that's the same thing Francis Schaeffer said 45 years earlier. He said the problem with strip mining is greed. So where does all that lead us? This paper turned out to be more theological than I would have thought, and also a different theme than I would have thought a year ago. I think our Christian faith gives us many insights into problems of sustainable engineering. I again strongly recommend, if you haven't read Laudato Si, which is easily in print. Schaeffer's book, I believe, is still in print, or at least it's certainly readily available. And that's a bit older and a bit dated, but it really says many of the very same things. I think also climate change is real and important, and Christian engineers need to understand what role they can play. And there are issues of technology, and I didn't want to get into that because we could spend a whole conference about technology. But if you have many friends who are climate deniers, change deniers, as I do, I think there's some strategies. I would say one, most Christians would say we need to be stewards of the world around us. If we emphasize that aspect, and you could talk about some of the climate change issues, whether you want to talk about temperature or not, you can certainly talk about pollution and other things that are changing. And people would say, well, that's not a good thing to do. And then the last one is, to me, a more of a tactics approach. Many of my friends, even if they would become convinced climate change is happening, they'd say, well, I don't want to do what those liberals do. And I'm not saying that what the liberals want is all bad. I wouldn't say that. But I'm just saying, I think you can emphasize to them there are market-based things. I don't think the market will solve all the problems by any means, but I think it can go a considerable ways to dealing with this problem. So again, in summary, this is a different paper than I thought I was going to do a year ago. I started to think about this almost as soon as I left ASA. But my perspective has changed. I think it's changed for the better. At least I think it's more faithful to the evidence we see around us. So by the clock up there, we've got about 4 minutes for questions or comments. Okay. Persuaded me of this by just the overwhelming evidence of what we studied in class.
Okay, my comment is that my colleague at home, with whom I had a long-running dialogue on climate change, he's a far-right Republican, sent me an article a half hour ago that was published in yesterday's Wall Street Journal. Yeah. The title is "Climate Change is Not the End of the World," and I speed-read it. And it says two things. First of all, it says that if the cost of implementing the solution is greater than the cost of damage that's projected, then we shouldn't do it.
As far as it goes, that's true, but I don't think that's the case for this.
Okay. The second point of the article is it's entirely U.S.-based. Western economies can afford to do what Rotterdam does, and therefore, we can do it, no problem.
Yeah.
So I sit back saying, this is terribly myopic, Andy.
Yeah.
Nevertheless, in the context of what we've heard here in this conference, there's the Wall Street Journal standing aside and saying different things.
Yeah. Well, I think the real issue is to show people and do some looking up of what companies are being more sustainable and more profitable. And I think that's something that can appeal to some of my really conservative friends. Here.
So I'm not sure who originated the term, but there's something out there called non-skeptical heretics on climate change. People who are convinced of the science, but not necessarily going along with the high government regulation-based solutions. And so that kind of language is okay. Out there. And I just wondered if you've heard of Bob Inglis's work at Republic EN, he calls his group, but he's, again, a fairly conservative leaning, but convinced of climate change and trying to seek market-based solutions.
I'm not familiar with them. One of the plenary speakers spoke about George Shultz, who was in Reagan administration and supported a version of a carbon tax that pays back dividends and is revenue neutral. That's something as a conservative I can support and I think would be beneficial. Yeah.
You might check into that.
Okay.
Republic EM.
Okay.
So it's Republican.
Yes?
So you stated that maybe the liberal solution is not the good solution or the solution you prefer. What do you see as the liberal solution? Because I don't know what that position is.
Well, first, I'm not going to say everything liberals support is bad. I would never say
that. No,
I would say the conservatives tend to think that all the liberal proposals are for government regulation. And I think government regulation plays a legitimate role, but it's not the only thing.
Yeah, I'm trying to get you specific. So in other words, are you saying a carbon tax, for example, is not the way to go?
No, actually, the version that George Shultz has proposed, I like.
Okay.
Because it's revenue neutral. That's the thing most conservatives rebel against.
So
we don't want taxes.
Environmental regulation is not.
Environmental regulations, I think, play a role. You can have legitimate arguments at the what level. An example is that if you measure the radiation coming out of the Library of Congress and apply nuclear power plant standards, they shut down the Library of Congress. And that's natural radiation. So I think I certainly support environmental regulation. The real fight is over at what level is needed. And the answer is we really frequently don't know what level is needed. I'd like to talk more, but I've used up my own time now. So I'll be glad to talk with you more about it. I'm very fascinated by this subject.